Once upon a time, there were four little rabbits.
How old are you, Johnny? She asked.
16.
We few, we happy few, we band of brothers.
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times.
A wise old king once said, "Of the making of books, there is no end." How true today. Of the overabundance of writing published each year, what's worth reading? The answer is simple. Read only the best. Come join the discussion on Just the Best Literature.
Hello again, everyone. Thanks for listening in today. Well, again, I don't have any comments today, and that's probably a good thing because we want to get right back in to our discussion of Dunkirk. Now, the last time I was reading to you from Manchester, and I want to continue just reading a few things, and then we're going to begin to discuss really some of the difficulties of Dunkirk, and then also, the miracles at Dunkirk. And also, just wanted to make a correction. Last time I said that the writer of the film Dunkirk was John Nolan. Actually, it was Christopher Nolan. And so, sorry about that. So, back with me in the studio again today is my wife, Deborah. So, welcome back.
Thank you. It's good to be here again.
Yeah. Sorry I didn't let you talk that much last time. But I'm just trying to get all these things out. All right. But essentially what I was trying to say by reading the Manchester thing last program is that France was really breaking down. And really the Germans were actually afraid of the French army. But they had lost their will to fight. And basically, if you look to the reason for that was in World War I, the French lost more troops than anybody else. It was devastating to France. And so, they just didn't have, a desire to fight. And so there, Winston Churchill, when he comes in now as prime minister, he also made himself as, the defense minister. And so he had control of the whole thing, but he needed to rely on France. And he began to realize that he couldn't. I'm just going to go on to page 75 just to tell you what's really going on with the British Expeditionary Force. This is kind of breaking into the middle of the thing here. It says, Waglan's troops still weren't advancing and Gord had not retreated. However, with each passing hour, the commander of the BEF, or the British Expeditionary Force, realized that he would have to do something, and soon. His army, the only army Britain had, was in mortal danger. Nearly encircled, trapped in a pocket of 70 miles from the sea and only 15 to 20 miles across, their lines of communication had been cut off. Their only allies were the Belgians and the remnants of the 1st French Army. The ports through which the BEF's 200,000 men were supplied were either bombed or already in enemy hands. The Tommies were down to a four-day supply of ammunition and rations. Panzers were in grave lines, barely 10 miles from Dunkirk, the BEF's last remaining port of escape. The panzers were closing in, and the Belgians were on the verge of surrender, already their last link with General Allenbroke's corps, northeast of Menin, had been broken, creating a breach between which the Nazis would pour once they found it. And so it was really, a really bad situation. Now, here's what was really amazing as well. And this is important that you understand this. This is page 77. He talks briefly about Lord Halifax. Lord Halifax, he said HMG's tall, ectomorphic foreign secretary thought this was an excellent time to negotiate a peace with Hitler. This is after he's taken, he's gone through Belgium, he's gone through the Netherlands, he's cutting a swath through the Ardennes forest, and Halifax thinks it's time to make peace. It was absolutely a crazy idea. But, of course, they were going to work through, the Italians. Now, I'll just skip down here. It says, the Italian ambassador to Britain, he reported, had approached with him with fresh proposals for a peace conference, and he thought they should seize the opportunity. Churchill replied that, yes, peace could be achieved under a German domination of Europe, but no, that was a condition we would never accept. And so I bring that out for a reason, because at the end of this program, we're going to talk a little bit about the darkest hour. And here I just want to read you another quick quote from Manchester. It says, a week before the Belgian surrender, and after almost 2 weeks of crushing defeats on the continent, Churchill asked Chamberlain to study the problems which would arise if it were necessary to withdraw the British expeditionary force from France. On Monday, May 20th, staff officers went through the motions of outlining a tentative plan. Assuming that Calais, Boulogne, and Dunkirk would be available, low-level planners believed they could evacuate 2,000 men a day. The hazardous evacuation of very large forces was briefly mentioned, then relegated to the bottom of the agenda. Its possibility seemed very remote. That changed in less than 24 hours. Tuesday morning, the emergency evacuations across the channel, a very large number of small vessels in readiness to proceed to ports and inlets on the French coast. Transport officers from Harwich to Weymouth were directed to list all ships up to 1,000 tons. The Admiralty appointed Vice Admiral Bertram Ramsay to command the operation. It was codenamed Dynamo. He was immediately given 36 ships, most of them cross-channel ferries. His headquarters, hacked out of Dover's White Cliffs, overlooked the troubled waters. And so the thing is, Churchill was the one that was really moving behind all this. Now, Ramsay, we're going to talk to you about this, some of the difficulties he had. And so, but by the 26th of May, London was in despair. At 7 o'clock that evening, the Admiralty, on Churchill's instructions, sent out the message, Operation Dynamo is to commence. On the 28th, with the evacuation from Dunkirk underway for almost 24 hours, Churchill warned the House of Commons to prepare itself for hard and heavy tidings. They didn't believe at that time they could get more than 2,000 a day. So now, I think that's enough introduction that we could go ahead and let's talk about what really happened at Dunkirk. And I know, Deborah, you've done some extra reading on this, so maybe you could begin.
Well, I did read this book, Dunkirk, A Miracle of Deliverance, by David Boyle. And it was because you hear about the miracles that happened at Dunkirk. I really didn't know much about it, and I don't understand some of the military terms. But it was interesting to see how there was a lot of planning and work that involved in it. And this Ramsay really worked hard to, before they even started the evacuation, to round up all different kinds of ships and boats, different sizes. Some, he started using civilians. They weren't all just people in the Navy, but they did use some of the big destroyers in order to, because they figured they would be able to get more people on the destroyers. But there was an awful lot of really, really hard work. And when they started doing the actual evacuations, the people who were doing the work of it got very, very tired and often didn't sleep. Didn't have food to eat, didn't have water. And so all those things you don't think about had to be taken care of.
Right. It was massive. Manchester gives a great description of the ships. Mm-hmm. And, let me just read some of this. It says, by the morning of May 26th, the Navy had assembled a ragtag, and this is Ramsay, a ragtag armada of 860 vessels in Dover. Of Britain's 160 destroyers, almost half were attached to the home fleet, and only 41 were available. These had to be augmented by appealing to all yacht clubs along the coast and by commandeering everything afloat in English waters. So they used yachts.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they were going to use whatever they could find. In addition, French, Belgian, and Dutch skippers had volunteered, bringing their Argosy total to 900 boats. On May 26th, they were anchored three deep along the Dover quays. Trawlers, river barges, schooners, minesweepers, fireboats, corvettes, Hospital ships, fishing sloops, launches, paddle wheelers, smacks, coasters, lifeboats, scows, tugs. The London Fire Float, Massey Shaw, the ferries Brighton Queen and Grace Fields, channel packs such as the Princess Maud, and every variety of pleasure craft. Tom Sopwith's American Cup Challenger Endeavor was there with him at the helm. So were the launch Count Dracula, the yacht Sundowner, piloted by Commander Charles H. Lightroller, the senior surviving officer of the Titanic, and the Yangtze gunboat Mosquito. So those were the boats that they used. And it's just kind of fascinating how they did that.
It's also interesting. This book mentions they had trouble with manpower as well. As I said, there were a lot of civilians. Well, it says that there was a school of salesmanship, and the captain there heard through the grapevine about the desperate need for navigators and others who knew how to handle boats. So he sent messages to his pupils. There would be no classes that following week, and urged them to report to Navy's London headquarters. So as many as 73 of his 75 pupils did so and were allocated to ship's lifeboats, some of them still in their city suits and bowler hats.
Yeah.
So you can imagine, it would have been quite a spectacle.
So everybody knows what a bowler hat is. Those are just classic, the classic British hat. So one other thing I wanted to just say, maybe in terms of this, how absolutely dangerous this was to use these kind of boats, and it's because of crossing the English Channel. Now we need to set this up,
yes,
so
mm-hmm.
that we can talk about the miracles. But here's again, Manchester gives us a lot on it. He says, just crossing the channel, 40 miles wide at this point, was harrowing for amateurs. The sea was choppy, and since the outbreak of the war, lightships and lighted buoys had been blackened out, and the enemy was continuously mining these waters. The Navy swept three narrow lanes, vessels that strayed from them, and some did, went down, lying off the French coast between shoals, awaiting their turn to go in. Helmsmen tried desperately in narrow waters to take evasive action against the German aircraft, which seemed to be everywhere. Then, when they went in, as far in as they could get, they saw the long serpentine lines of Tommies stretching over the dunes. To the crews of boats entering after sunset, weaving between the sunken hulks, the beaches seemed to be swarming with fireflies. These were the lighted cigarettes of infantrymen awaiting a ride home. Some men stood waist-deep in water for hours, praying for rescue, but though bombed and machine-gunned, none broke. And so go ahead.
That's right. At this time, still, the Luftwaffe was bombing periodically, and So some of these men stood for like maybe a day, and because they realized if they got out of the line, they had to do something to get something to eat or get a drink, and then they'd have to go back at the end of the line. So just getting on the ship was a lot of work, as well as all the work that was done to get them there. And they had to get a lot of small ships, small boats, to go on the beach for them to get in the small ship in order to take it to the larger destroyers, because like I said, you mentioned before, that the ports had been all destroyed.
Yes.
So
yeah, even Dunkirk was in bad shape.
Right. Yes. They found a quay that, and they used that like almost like a dock, you know, in order to be able to get them on.
It was made out of wood, but they mm-hmm. could, yes. they were afraid they wouldn't be able to get the bigger ships in there. But some of them had to just wait out from the beach,
right? Yes,
and not be picked up, mm-hmm. but the thing is that maybe we should mention, and we forgot to mention, so there's over 200,000 British Expeditionary Force to be picked up. Then there was 100,000 French and Belgian soldiers that needed to be picked up as well. So we're talking over 300,000 people had to be evacuated. So it really was just an amazing thing. Here, let me just say this. It says, the Germans bombed the jetty again and again. One morning it took a direct hit from a low-flying bomber. Ship's carpenters passed it. Another bomb hit the hull of the paddle wheel steamer Fenella below the waterline just after she had been boarded by 600 troops. She sank immediately, taking them with her. Nevertheless, the mole did all that could have reasonably been asked of it, and as did the little boats. Repeatedly, they ran aground. Soldiers would push them off and vault aboard, sometimes overload a craft capsized, drowning the heavily laden Tommies. Some crewmen brought collapsible boats. Soldiers tried to paddle with their gun butts. It didn't work. They tried their luck elsewhere. Makeshift piers were put together with trucks, wreckage, and driftwood. The skipper of a minesweeper raised his bow as high as possible, came in at 12 knots, and dropped two stern anchors as he beached. So they were really working very hard to get these troops out, and it really was. I really think it's really, that was a great name for it, Operation Dynamo, because it was really a lot of hard work. But maybe we ought to now spend some time in talking about what miracles happened. And, a lot of people don't like to talk about God or the fact that God intervenes. But the Bible is pretty clear that God intervenes for the nations that look to God. And one of the things that Manchester does bring out, and there's a few other articles that bring it out, that it was really the king that when they were beginning this whole effort to rescue everybody from Dunkirk, it was the king that asked for the nation to pray that God would rescue them. And then things really began to turn in their favor once the nation began to pray. And one of the things that I could just bring out real quickly is that Hitler stopped his advance. And, Hitler, they were so arrogant, they thought the Luftwaffe, or the airplanes, could win it for them. And he also backed off. Well, the other reason he backed off, remember, he was in World War One, in the trenches, just the same as Churchill was. And he was afraid of moving his tanks further in because there had been a lot of rain. So now let's talk about the miracles. So
yeah, so there's several, a lot of people over the years have speculated about why he gave the order to halt, the stop order. And if he hadn't, the Germans would have come in and destroyed all the Allies. They were right ready to do that. But he gave the order to halt. And like you said, some people say it's because he was afraid of the tanks getting mired in the marshes there because of what happened in World War One.
Right.
I've read all kinds of different thoughts, that there was the vanity thinking, oh, let's just save our troops and our tanks and let the Luftwaffe take care of it. They'll take care of it. So but in any case, that was a definite miracle because it was the amount of time that it allowed. For nearly 3 days, and this is all when England was praying, nothing moved. They didn't move any tanks. The troops didn't come. It was the exact window of time the British needed to form a defensive perimeter to temporarily fight back the Germans and establish a funnel for the troops to flow through to the English Channel. Because remember, it's not just the difficulty of getting the troops off the beaches, but they had to get a lot of the troops to the beach. They were still trying to get them there. So that was definitely amazing, and no historians can't deny that happened.
Right. You can look on secular sources, and they'll say this is an incredible miracle. Okay, let's go to the next point, or the next miracle.
Well, there was another thing that happened were rain and clouds, and the German planes had been bombing Dunkirk, but then each time for days afterward, the city was enveloped by inclement weather, making any follow-up from the Nazis difficult. So although they were still bombing, there was a cloud cover that made it really difficult for them to do it and to see.
Right, because when we're talking World War II, we're not talking about the sophisticated airplanes we have today.
Right,
so
yes.
If you don't have clear skies, it's hard to put the airplanes in the air and then bomb.
Yes, and if you might include in that is some of the things that happened also is that things were burning, and there was an oil depot that actually put some smoke in the air that also gave some help to the hiding them.
Yeah, I mean so, that was mm-hmm. I think it was Goering. I think he was over at the Luftwaffe, and he just said they were going to win because of that.
And the one thing I read said that the Allied exodus actually went undetected for days.
Right.
Because of that.
They couldn't see it.
They didn't
right.
see it. Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, all right, let's go. There's supposedly four miracles. So what's the third one?
Well, the other fourth one is and
the
you mentioned,
the third one,
is the English Channel. Like you say, normally it's very, very rough and choppy. Well, it was amazingly smooth. Several days when there's barely a ripple. It was like a bathtub. Some people described it that way.
Churchill would have loved it.
Yes.
He loved his bath.
Yes. So it says somewhere, a person named Hilton Shaw encountered was like that of a bathtub. Yes. So they hadn't seen anything like it. So that wasn't really unusual. And anyone who was there knows that. Although sometimes it seems like historians don't talk about that now. I know this one book I read didn't even bring that up.
You're talking about David Boyle's
book. Yeah, David Boyle. He doesn't even bring up the fact that it was not choppy. He does mention that there was some cloud cover, and of course he talks about Hitler's order, but he doesn't mention the fact that the sea, the channel was actually
unusually smooth. Yeah, there was more than one time during World War II that Hitler made stupid decisions that actually favored the Allies. And so, you can look at the text, you know, 1 Kings and 2 Kings and in some of the battles, even with Hezekiah, we have the big exhibit here at our headquarters offices, is that even, you know, Sennacherib, some of them would make stupid decisions. And yet it would give an advantage to God's people. And certainly we believe that the English are, you know, we believe they're definitely God's people. They're Ephraimites. And when they turned to God in prayer, God began to work things out. I think even one of the miracles that it was just the number of people and the different kinds of people and types of people that ran the boats. I mean, they had, you know, professional people. They had everybody would get out there, and they'd get into rowboats. They would get into all kinds of different crafts, and the fishing trawlers, even people that had motorboats, you know, that they used for fishing. The waters of the English Channel were so calm, you could get out there and not get drowned from it. So I think it's there's so much there that people are not willing to talk about or, you know, in our supposedly sophisticated society today where we just have no faith in God. But we are moving to a time where, you know, if God doesn't protect America and doesn't protect Canada and Britain and all of the English-speaking nations, I mean, if God isn't our protection, we're in for some big trouble. So I just wanted to go ahead and read just a little bit more from Manchester, and then I think we're going to have a little time. If not, we'll have to read it. I'll read it on my next program. But here's what Manchester says. On May 28th, the number of evacuees was low, 17,800. All this day of the 28th, Churchill wrote afterward, the escape of the British Army hung in the balance. On May 29th, however, the figure was 47,310. On May 30th, 53,823. On May 31st, 68,014. On June 1st, 64,429. On June 2nd, 26,256. That was supposed to be the end of it, but Admiral Ramsay made one last perilous attempt to lift off the gallant French rear guard, and he returned with 26,175 Polis. Altogether, Dynamo rescued 338,226 Allied soldiers, 112,000 of them French, although a great number of French troops turned and went home to take their chances. But here's what Churchill said, and this is what's really important. We don't want to forget this. Now, he made two comments. This one was the more of the funny one. He said, behind them they left their luggage. as Churchill put it, 2,540 artillery pieces, 90,000 rifles, 11,000 machine guns, nearly 700 tanks, 6,400 anti-tank rifles, 20,000 motorcycles, 45,000 trucks and other vehicles, and vast ammunition dumps. Now, here's the point, though, that this is from Churchill, the warrior statesman. He says, still, the news added up to disaster. On June 4th, Churchill told the House the story of Dunkirk. Wars, he told them bluntly, are not won by evacuations. And what happened in France and Belgium is a colossal military disaster. Nevertheless, he said, Dunkirk was a miracle of deliverance achieved by valor, by perseverance, by perfect discipline, by faultless service, by recourse, by skill, by unconquerable fidelity. Britain would outlive the menace of tyranny, if necessary for years, if necessary alone. So there was his final comment. But again, I think that shows he certainly didn't necessarily believe that God was behind it or supporting it. But we know that other historians see that as the way it was, that it really was that divine intervention that delivered them or delivered everybody from Dunkirk. But I think we'd all agree with Churchill. It was really like a mitigated defeat to have to evacuate like that. Well, that's all we have time for today's program. Next time, I'll give you my final thoughts on Paul Johnson's Churchill. The next book in this series, also by Paul Johnson, is titled George Washington, Founding Father. And our third book in this series is Hero, The Life and Legend of Lawrence of Arabia. You can find both books on Amazon. You can find used copies of the books at abebooks.com. Of course, you can also check your local library. Please write me any comments you may have to jbl@pcog.org. You can follow JBL on Twitter at JBLiterature1. You can also follow JBL on Facebook. Simply search for Just the Best Literature. And remember, you can leave me a comment at Facebook. So until next time, keep reading.
You've been listening to Just the Best Literature on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, streaming online at kpcg.fm and thetrumpet.com.